You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us on the line right now is Jonah Goldberg. He's the National Review Senior Editor, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a good guy. Hello, Jonah. Good morning to you.
Hey, Brian. It's great to be here, guys.
You know, a lot of people are looking forward to the Trump administration, and we want to get into that in just a moment. But it is also a time where we stop and we say, look, we've just had 8 years of the Obama White House, the Obama presidency, and we just had a big speech by him in Chicago in which he tried to lay out the things that he thinks he has accomplished during that time. As we look back over the past 8 years, what are the things that strike you as we see the end of the Obama era?
I don't know. I mean, that's a tough one because there's so much and so little at the same time.
Yeah.
I think basically a big chunk of the Obama era was just an enormous wasted opportunity. I think that people don't really, you know, despite what the sort of left-wing narrative is, there was an enormous amount of goodwill for Barack Obama when he came into office. His popularity ratings were through the roof, which meant that a lot of white people, a lot of white Republicans, a lot of white independents, conservative independents, people who ended up voting for Mitt Romney and Donald Trump, supported him. And Barack Obama spent 8 years talking about how he was just simply a non-ideological pragmatist while running one of the most rigidly ideological administrations of our lifetimes. And he was just never open to anything other than his own program. And while saying he was open to good ideas wherever they came from, and it's, you know, I mean, first of all, and last of all, you know, the racial healing that has taken place in these last 8 years is really remarkable. And so I find it a sort of depressing thing, and I thought his farewell address was really deplorable in the sense that this is the first president, not just that it was the first president in American history to hold a huge narcissistic campaign rally as his farewell address, but that no one really commented on it. No one was offended by it. That's the new normal. And, you know, people complain about Donald Trump being an entertainer and being all about theatrics. Well, you know, look at that farewell address. That was not someone sitting in the Oval Office reading a very reserved, you know, warning about your feelings about the future. It was a campaign rally masquerading as a farewell address.
Right. And he enjoyed celebratory coverage of that from most places. And, you know, if you look interestingly about Obama and what he's governed over the last 8 years, partly he's governed a dramatic wounding of the Democratic Party. In every state in the country, Democrats have lost traction with elected officials for the most part. Yet Obama enjoys a 55% approval rating right now.
Yeah, so it's funny. I mean, I hear from a lot of liberal friends and liberal readers who point to that 55% approval rating as if it's a repudiation of every criticism of Barack Obama. And the thing is that Barack Obama has always been personally popular. Barack Obama has always been more popular than his ideas. And the thing is that his only true gift as a politician, everyone talks about what a masterful politician he is, the only gift he has had that he's demonstrated time and again is his ability to sell himself. He can't sell his ideas. He never made Obamacare popular. He can't sell the Democratic Party's program. The Democratic Party is like it's been hit by a neutron bomb. They've lost over 1,000 officials in the last 8 years at the state, local, and federal level. He's hollowed out completely the sort of moderate moderate Democrat wing of the party. They've all were destroyed by Obamacare. And yet these liberals say, but look, he's personally popular. Well, okay, he's at 55%. That's not exactly, you know, Putin levels. But second of all, it just points to the fact that this has always been about him. He's never been able to transfer his political charisma to anybody else. He's never had coattails. He's never been able to sell anything but himself. And that's what's destroyed the Democratic Party over the last 8 years.
I want to get into how it's gone for Donald Trump and his nominees this week. It seems to me things are going pretty smoothly, with the possible exception of Marco Rubio coming after Rex Tillerson, the man that Donald Trump has chosen to be his next Secretary of State.
Yeah, I was a little surprised. I thought Rex Tillerson had a wobblier performance than I expected. I was being contrarian. A lot of people were saying he was going to be in trouble, and I didn't think he would be. because I know people who know him and they're really impressed by him, and I think he's a very impressive man, but I just don't think he was up to the rigors of the committee in the ways that, like, you know, General Mattis or Pompeo were. And that's understandable. The guy started out as an engineer at ExxonMobil and never left. And so it's just a different skill set, and it probably takes a little while to get his sea legs. But all in all, I think most of the disappointments, at least the ones we've seen so far, have been either pretty good or great and reassuring, even for people like me who are more skeptical about the sort of the great Trumpian new world to come.
Yeah, you know, it seems that over the past few days, the big dividing line has been how do these nominees respond to questions about Russia? Rex Tillerson took as diplomatic approach as he could, but Mike Pompeo and General Mattis both came out with a little more strength, and that's led to a lot of applause from Democrats. How are you viewing the fact that they're just injecting Russia into all these nomination hearings?
Well, okay, so there are a couple things going on. One is the Democrats are just desperate to muddy, taint, sour the Trump presidency, to create this narrative of illegitimacy from the beginning. I get it. I understand it. But it's also pretty cynical and duplicitous, particularly coming from people who complained about, you know, I mean, I get it. What's good for the goose is good for the gander when it comes to Trump for a lot of people because of the birtherism. But if you thought the birtherism stuff was wrong and delegitimizing a president, you should also think delegitimizing his successor is bad, too. But also, I think one of the things that a lot of people aren't appreciating is Donald Trump can get away with saying a lot of things. I think everybody can agree on that. He can get away with saying stuff that no other politician can say. And that goes for Russia, too. If General Mattis or Rex Tillerson or any of these guys in confirmation hearings or even a senator had said half as many laudatory things of Vladimir Putin that Donald Trump has said, they'd be eaten alive by the political establishment. But Trump gets a pass on saying these things about Russia for whatever reason. We can debate that. But basically everybody else just understands that the safe and correct position is a more establishment position of deep skepticism about Russia. And what it's creating is kind of a good cop, bad cop thing between Trump and his own administration, which may, in fact, end up being a beneficial and useful thing.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Jonah Goldberg from National Review, and you see him all the time on Fox News. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here, guys. Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
You were the change. You answered people's hopes. And because of you, by almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
That was the president last night giving his big farewell rally slash address in Chicago. And he gave a very glowing assessment of where America is and a very glowing assessment of all the things that he has accomplished as president of the United States. And, well, I'm just wondering, you know, how did you assess it? Do you have the same vision of it that the president had? Well, joining us on the line right now with probably a slightly different approach and a view of this is Dinesh D'Souza, filmmaker famous for this Hillary's America and the 2016 Obama's America documentaries. Joins us on the line for his take on the Obama legacy. Good morning to you, Mr. D'Souza.
Hello. It's good to be on the show.
It's good to have you on the show. It's, by the way, Brian Wilson alongside Tony Schaefer this
morning.
So here's the question. As you listen to this, it was a well-written, well-delivered speech. Nobody can deny that. But a lot of people look at it and say, look, we just went through a change election. And that means that a lot of people were ready for a change from Obama's America rather than looking at it in a rather glowing way.
Yeah, Obama has this amazing capacity to produce the surreal. And that is, he stands up and he's surrounded by a kind of halo and he talks and you have to sort of slap yourself to realize that what he's saying bears no resemblance to reality. I mean, for example, Obama focuses on this idea, let's have some national unity. Now, ironically, there was national unity in 2008 when Obama was elected. Even Republicans were tempted by Obama's idea that there's no red America, there's no blue America, there's only the United States of America, which Obama had thunderously said in the 2000, had said in an earlier Democratic convention. So Obama, in order to have this national unity, needed to do only two things. On the racial side, he needed to do nothing. The mere symbolism of him being there would have had a positive effect. Politically, he just needed to make some overtures to the other side so those of us who are on the Republican side could see that he was our president as well. Now, ironically, he has done his utmost over 8 years to poison this national unity. Not for one day in 8 years have I, or I would say most conservatives, ever felt that Obama was looking out for us, protecting our values, protecting our interests. On the racial front, he was positively aggressive in poisoning the wells. And so it's positively ridiculous for him now, the great divider, the great underminer of national unity, to call for national unity now. We wouldn't need it if he had done his job.
Well, that's one of the issues I think is clear here. And I'm a political scientist by trade, and I actually study the American political system. And notably, in my judgment, our system is designed to actually allow for multiple voices to be heard in such a way to create effect, not that we all become one in thinking and in action. So he talked about improvement in measures. What measures do you think he was referring to in his speech that are improved from his perspective?
Well, I think that what's going on here is a bit of a sleight of hand.
Right.
Obama is talking about improvements from his own disastrous record. So, for example, he will run up the deficit in the first 3 years of his presidency to $1 trillion. This is per year. Now, let's remember that in the Reagan year, the left was screaming about, quote, $200 billion deficits as far as the eye can see. So what were annual deficits under Reagan became monthly deficits under Obama. Now, having run up trillion-dollar deficits, if the deficit then goes down to $600 billion, Obama claims, we've slashed the deficit by $400 billion. Wait a minute. You've slashed it from your own previous scandalous high level,
right,
and you call this progress. So that's
right.
The kind of bogus arithmetic that Obama subjects us to. It relies on complete gullibility to go along with it.
Well, one thing before we go, I just want to addendum to this is his claim that no act of terror from a foreign terror organization happened on his watch. I don't know how I can say that with a straight face based on everything that's happened. How do you think he thinks of that?
I mean, the way to answer that is that we're not, you know, acts of terror are bad, but to create entire mechanisms or institutions of terror is much worse.
Right.
So before Obama, there was no ISIS. There was Al-Qaeda, which is essentially a website of terrorists, a kind of international network, but with no basis, with no army, with no land, with no hope of building any kind of caliphate. Now, ISIS is completely different. This is an army. It controls large swaths of territory in places like Iraq and Syria. It proposes a serious threat to real governments. And this all developed under Obama due to a vacuum of leadership and a vacuum of power.
No doubt.
So Obama's statement, purely nonsensical, and relies merely on the fact that we haven't had a 9/11 during his 8 years.
Right.
All right. So also a claim that, well, we've had all this job growth. That's the one that I just look and I say, yeah, if you manipulate the figures in a certain way, it certainly would appear that. But it's really not the case, is it?
The simple truth of the matter is that the American economy is stagnant and has been stagnant now for some time. In order to see this, we simply have to look around the world. I just got back from a trip to India visiting my family. The Indian economy is in transformation. I mean, every time I go there, I see visible improvements in people's standard of living. Now, who with a straight face would say that apart from technological innovations, which is the iPhone and so on, Obama has nothing to do with that, who would say that the actual condition of American middle-class people, working people, is visibly improved in the 8 years under Obama? That's just ridiculous. It's not true, and no, there's no data that says it is true. So, as you say, there's just manipulations of data, the unemployment rate is we've added 300,000 new jobs. No one knows what any of that actually means. The bottom line of it is the American economy has been stuck in the ground for the entire 8 years of the Obama administration.
And so many people have given up the search for work, and that number is not often talked about.
And this is what's driven the success of Trump. If Obama really had produced these improvements, it would be like Reagan in 1984. I mean, essentially, Reagan swept a victory, winning 49 states. Hillary would easily have won on the coattails of Obama, who campaigned furiously for her. But I think the American people have had enough. So Obama's rhetoric operates in a sense, detached like a balloon from reality.
Well, this sounded to me more like a speech laying the path to his post-presidential political activities. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think it also shows that for the whole 8 years, Obama has sort of lived in the prison of his own distorted mind. This is a man who's capable of manufacturing, if you will, castles in the air. And he continues to have this megalomaniacal view of himself as if he looks at himself for an hour in the mirror every day and really likes what he sees.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you so much for your perspective. I think it was sorely needed this morning.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
That's right. That's. Yeah. Everybody. Tucker Carlson is moving up, baby. I mean, I'm telling you, you ever seen a more meteoric rise in all of the media? Never been a case like Tucker Carlson. Comes on, gets this big 7 o'clock show, and then barely gets it established. Numbers are just going great, and then he gets that coveted 9 p.m. slot on the Fox News Channel.
All that drama just instantly disappears because Tucker has it.
That's right. Hey, Tucker, good morning.
Well, good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, congratulations.
I love that music.
I know, me
I'm
too.
I'm trying to convince him to play that tonight, but I don't think they're going to go for it.
All right.
It's hilarious. Thank you.
So Tucker, tell me, your initial show at 7 o'clock. It's been a big hit. It's been noted for its really hard hitting interviews with interesting people from time to time. Are we going to see many changes as you move up to the new hour?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know. You sort of bring what you have. I mean, in the end, viewers either like and believe you or they don't, and there's not a ton you can do about it. I mean, you can. You know, you can make tweaks, of course. It's later. I mean, I think there's newsmakers are kind of expected at 9, and so there'll be more of that. But in general, you have what you have. So that's it. I mean, really, a lot of it, as you know, since you worked here for so long, is the channel itself. If you're on Fox, you do well because Fox does well.
Did you see the quote from Joe Concha, who said, Fox does not rebuild. Fox reloads.
Exactly,
and that is so exactly. That was so on target. I thought.
Yeah, literally on target. No, I agree. And the one thing you don't want to do is convince yourself that people are watching you because they love you. I mean, really, it. I've worked at a bunch of different places, and I put on a couple good shows that didn't do well. Partly was my fault, but partly was just nobody watched. The network I was on. So. Yeah. If I do well, I think most of 99% of it just happens to be the fact I'm here.
You know, Tucker, I should mention, of course, that I'm the editor of the Daily Caller, which a job that Tucker recently relinquished to me. But
you're doing a better job than I did.
Thank you. So let me move into the question about your new gig, which is at the 7 p.m. hour. What you've done differently than from almost every show in news is you've had primary sources on, where you bring in sort of like the protest leader or the person who's sort of leading the charge in this news story that's sort of symbolic for the rest of the country. Why is it that it took so long for somebody in cable news to figure out if we just interview people that actually have something to do with the news, then we might get some ratings out of it?
Well, that's how I feel. I mean, I want to hear from people who know what they're talking about or at least have some direct connection to the story. I think there is in general, not just in television but in life, too much reliance on self-styled experts who don't know much. And having been a self-styled expert for a long time, I can say that firsthand. You know what I mean? Sometimes I think, well, what? Who cares what I think? I want to hear from someone who's directly involved. I just think it's more interesting and more meaningful. And it's a harder booking, I'll tell you that. That has been our main problem. It's hard to book people who aren't expecting to go on TV when they wake up in the morning. And there's a whole class of people in D.C. who sort of, go to work wearing a tie because who knows what might happen.
Right.
And they're great. I mean, I like all of them. And, I've been one of them for a long time. But, to book someone who finds himself in the middle of something or unexpectedly famous, that's a tougher task.
So here in Washington right now, we're 11 days away from the inauguration of Donald Trump. One of the things that's been really interesting in watching this guy is he's not even in office, and yet he seems to have a real impact on this town. And literally, as we were talking earlier, people are sort of, they're having their cages rattled by this guy even before he gets sworn into office.
Well, that's right, and part of it's legitimate. I mean, Trump is a volatile guy, and he's a non-traditional guy, and it's not clear what he thinks about a whole bunch of things. So, people are nervous about that. He's unpredictable, and I think that's a good reason to be nervous. Part of the reason they're upset, though, is less legitimate, and it's because he threatens them and their dumb little sinecures or their stupid ways of doing things, their livelihoods here in D.C., and I mean the political class, the consultants, the bloviators, the politicians, and a lot of those people, and they're my friends, but they deserve to go do something real with their lives. You know what I mean? Like, learn how to set tile or put on a roof or learn to plumb a house or, get some real skills. And so they're hoping to crush him before he even, leaves the ICU. I mean, they want to end this before it begins by weakening him, and because they're afraid of him.
Well, this week we're going to see a bunch of nominees come forward through the Senate confirmation process, and a lot of these fights I expect are going to be proxy fights for why people dislike Trump. They're going to bring up Trump tweets, Trump statements, and see and weigh them against all of these nominees to see whether or not they agree and try and impose them as outcasts.
Exactly.
And in so doing, who do you expect is going to be going to have the toughest time on this slate of nominees as we go forward into the week?
It's hard to tell. I mean, they'll take it out on the weakest, of course, on the wounded gazelle. That's who will be slayed ceremonially. But the one they're upset about...
Why does that
about,
scream Ben Carson to me? I don't know why.
Yeah, it might be. But the one they're upset about is Jeff Sessions. And they know he's going to get it. I mean, he's served in the Senate for decades. He's been vetted, obviously. They hate his views on immigration. That's what it's really about. And they're going to call him a racist because that's the easiest way to discredit him. It won't work, but they're going to try. But what they're really mad about is the idea that he might slow the waves of immigrants coming into our country, legally and illegally, that have helped the Democratic Party and helped employers looking for low-wage labor. I mean, that's what it's actually about. He is a threat to them, and that's a significant job. Attorney General is the most significant appointment, obviously, that any president can make, and they're enraged that Sessions got it. So he'll get the job, but other people are going to pay the price.
All right, so tell us what you're going to have on the show tonight.
Well, we've got a lot of good stuff. Actually, to be totally honest with you, we have a great lead guest, but I'm completely paranoid he's going to cancel at the last minute, so I can't say who it is. In fact, I'm so paranoid we're pre-taping it just because I just want to get it in the can. But we have that's not a tease. That's for real. We have a really good first guest, but it's just hard for me to believe he'll actually come.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating. And now I definitely got to tune in to find
Well,
out.
I mean, I'm probably more paranoid than I would normally be just because it's our first night. But yeah, I think it'll be good for sure.
All right. Well, listen, it sounds great. And, look, you've always been a good friend of this program. But I just want to point out, we really like it when good things happen to good people. And Tucker Carlson, not a more deserving guy in the world. Congratulations on this.
Thank you.
On this wonderful opportunity. Just knock it out of the park, my friend. Or as they say in television news and in the theater, break a leg, buddy.
I hope not literally, but thank you, Brian.
All right. Tucker Carlson, always a pleasure. Hey!
Go get him, Tucker.
Let's just play that. Huh? When's the last time you heard this song? Moving on up. All right.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Brian Wilson filling in today here as my guest host is Vince Colonnaise with the Daily Caller. And we're very pleased to have on the line D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. Good morning, Ms. Mayor.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
We're doing very, very well.
Fantastic. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year. I know you want to talk about the accountability report that came out yesterday and how you feel like the District of Columbia is in a good place. So what were the major findings of this speech, and what is going right in the District of Columbia?
Well, a lot is going right, and we welcome members of our 300-person transition team for me to give them a report. We heard from our CFO about how well we're doing from the fiscal standpoint in the district, and we talked about schools, we talked about neighborhoods, we talked about attracting businesses and putting people to work. So in all of those indicators, the district is moving in the right direction.
You know, I remember a time when the finances in this town were really a mess, and really you find yourself to be fiscally in order.
Absolutely. So one thing that I emphasize to everybody is that in talking about how things are changing and the landscape is changing on a federal level, we can report to a new president and the Congress that we have 21 consecutive balanced budgets, that we have reserves in the bank that will allow our city to run for almost 60 days. And we're making the types of investments in our schools and neighborhoods that allow us to continue to attract residents and businesses.
I want to ask you about some news that has just crossed our wire this morning about Jason Chaffetz, who runs the Government Accountability Oversight Committee on Capitol Hill in the House, who has let it be known that he plans to block the D.C. law allowing assisted suicide, that he's going to work against that, and something that is rarely done. But of course, Congress does have the right to review bills that are passed by the council, and he says he's going to do everything he can to stop that law from becoming law. Your reaction?
Well, Brian, we're disappointed that the congressman, given all that the nation has to be concerned about, would be at all concerned about a local law that was unanimously passed, 11-2 passed by the Council of the District of Columbia. So just like we have over the course of our home rule fought back challenges at the Congress, we'll fight this one back too.
So you think you have some case of prevailing, really?
The Congress being involved in this matter, it really makes no sense at all. We know that they're focused on approving nominations of a new president, working on the challenging issues that they have that face our nation. It almost makes no sense at all for any committee to be focused on a local law in D.C.
Mayor Bowser, Vince Colonnaise here. And my question for you is about this assisted suicide. And, you know, we have people nationwide who look to the District of Columbia ultimately as obviously the center of our government. And they have a lot of problems with people who are for helping people die, literally using medication to kill them. Where are you on assisted suicide personally, and do you think it's the right policy for the district?
Well, I have signed the law into law in the district, and I respect the will of our legislature, where we have an overwhelming vote for the measure. So for me, this is a matter of local law. And defending local law. And as far as people across the nation who are concerned about assisted suicide, then these are issues that they can take up in their own states. Or if the Congress is concerned about it, it's an issue that they can take up for the whole nation. But just to isolate on Washington, D.C. is a violation of the principles of our democracy.
I think it's pretty meaningful to a lot of Americans, though. I know that the district, of course, is getting ready for the inaugural. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What's underway?
Absolutely. Last week, I called all of our federal partners together, our Department of Homeland Security, the Secret Service, and everybody that's going to support us, so that we can ensure that the district, of course, is putting its best foot forward in preparing for the inaugural. And I'm very pleased with how all the preparations are coming.
All right. I got to ask you about this other thing that I saw that you said yesterday regarding $500,000 that's being set aside for grants to help people who are here illegally. In other words, you're saying very, very firmly, D.C. will continue to be a sanctuary city, and we're going to set aside taxpayer dollars in order to defend their right to stay here in this country, even though they're here illegally. Do you think this is the way taxpayer dollars should be spent?
Well, Brian, what we're focused on are D.C. residents who live here, work here, have children here, and have children in our schools. And what we've seen over the last several months, is a real fear and anxiety in our city that I'm very concerned will make our city less safe. So it is important that everybody living in Washington know that they can call on the police, that they can help the police if there is any issue. They know that they can take advantage of city services that keep people safe. And I want to make that perfectly clear. But we also want people to be able to have legal advice that will allow them to live in Washington, D.C. and to work. And that is why, and through my Office for Latino Affairs, that we're going to have a grant program where nonprofits who already work in immigrant communities can make sure people know their rights and know all the processes available to them.
But you're talking about taxpayer dollars for people who are in this country illegally, and you're protecting them from doing what the federal law requires, that if they're here illegally, they should be taken out of this country and returned to their home country.
Well, actually, we just want to make them aware of the full array of legal services that are out there. For some, it will lead to asylum applications. For others, it will lead to applications for green cards. To others, they will already be in line to become citizens. But they need the legal help to get there. And that's what this program is set up to do.
Mayor Bowser, a few minutes ago when we were talking about assisted suicide, you did mention rightly that if the federal government wants to preclude a locality from behaving a certain way, that Congress should pass a law. In this case...
I said if there was a national concern
yes.
about death with dignity or measures like that,
yes.
then that would make more sense.
Right. So, but in this case, the Congress has passed a law related to undocumented immigrants, as you call them, or illegal immigrants, being in the United States, and D.C. is willfully flouting that law.
No, what we're doing is serving D.C. residents who already live here and work here, and we don't want to make the statement that if you live here and work here that you're going to be less safe and less able to take advantage of services that will make the whole city safe. And that's what we're focused on.
Well, our time is running down, and we really appreciate you joining us. Just one back thing with the inaugural. Security is a concern. We're reading stories about anarchists who are going to come in here and try to disrupt things and block people from coming into the city. Do you have confidence based on what you've seen from your police department that they can handle this?
Absolutely, Brian. You know, there have been about 56 national security events since the Department of Homeland Security was started. About half of those events have been held right here in Washington, D.C. So we have the apparatus and we have the relationships with our federal partners to put on these events. Our last big one was the visit of the Pope to Washington, D.C., where we, you know, had, you know, extra security and lane closures and the
right.
like, and we were very proud of how everybody worked together to get this done. So not only will we have our police officers and the federal forces, but we'll also have National Guard troops that will help us man the perimeter around the parade route as well. So we expect, like other inaugurals, this one to be smooth as well.
All right. Listen, thank you so much for spending time with us, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser.
Thanks, Brian.
Bye. That was a wide-ranging interview. Boy.
That was good stuff. And thank the mayor for being on this morning.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. 5 to 9, Monday through Friday. Only on 105.9 FM. WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
We've talked to you in recent days about how Kalorama is going to be the hot spot in this town, it appears. I mean, we've already told you that the president is renting a property, and he's going to live there with the family, at least until the kids get through college in Kalorama. Then Ivanka and Jared Kushner, they bought a place in Kalorama, and they're just a few minutes away from where the president, the former president, the soon-to-be former president will be. It's sort of weird, you know, trying to determine what we call these people right now. the current president, who will soon be the former president. When he's former president, he's going to live in Kalorama, not far from Ivanka.
It's a tough period for honorifics. It's very hard to figure this out.
It is. And now comes word that the third richest man in the world has bought a huge property, the largest house in all of D.C. in that same neighborhood, Jeff Bezos. He's the owner of the Washington Post, of course, the owner of Amazon.
This is what you call prime real estate.
It's a modest little place, 27,000 square feet. I mean, it used to be the textile museum. It's actually two mansions that are sort of connected one to the other. It's a huge piece of property, and for the asking price of a mere $23 million.
The place has more bathrooms than it has bedrooms. 10 bedrooms, 14 bathrooms in it. And by the way, 11 fireplaces.
11 fireplaces. Well, apparently it has been used as a home in some time, so some renovation will be underway. But welcome to Kalorama, Jeff Bezos.
But remember, in D.C., no drone delivery to your home.
That's right.
Sorry.
No, can't have that.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live on 105.9 FM WMAL.